Welcome to HealthCast, where leaders and experts from Stony Brook Medicine come together to discuss a range of topics, from leadership and strategic planning to patient care and the inner workings of a successful healthcare system.
Hello, and welcome to HealthCast. My name is Carol Gomes, and I serve as Chief Executive Officer and Chief Operating Officer at Stony Brook University Hospital. It's Women's History Month, and we have an exciting lineup today of women in research, medicine, and leadership, all to discuss some of the barriers we've faced as women in these fields, how far we've come, what the future holds, and more. I myself have been a woman in healthcare for many years and a woman in position of leadership for about 15 years. It's been my absolute privilege to serve the Stony Brook community in this capacity, and I'm looking forward to this conversation today. First, we have Dr. Sharon Nachman and Dr. Zella Cirka joining us today. Dr. Nachman, let's start with you. If you can introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers.
So nice to see everybody. My name is Sharon Nachman. I'm the Division Chief for Pediatric Infectious Disease at Stony Brook Children's. And like you, Carol, have been here for many years.
Welcome. We're really pleased to have you here today, Dr. Nachman. I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you.
Also, Dr. Cirka, can you introduce yourself as well?
Yes, of course. Hi, Sharon. Hi, Carol. I'm Stella Cirka. I'm a faculty in the Department of Pharmacology, and I also serve in the School of Medicine as Vice Dean for Faculty Affairs. I have been here for pre-millennium.
Well, we're really excited to have both of you today. So wonderful. Let's get ready to dive in. Are we ready?
Yep.
Okay, sure. Great. So let's start with a question. And Sharon, would you like to answer this one? What inspired you to pursue a career in research?
So interestingly enough, most people talk about a teacher that they had or a professor. I'm actually going to talk about my grandmother, who was a very strong individual, a survivor of World War II, who actually moved her family and my father and my uncle from nothing, where they were living in Siberia, to the United States. And what she showed me clearly was you have to have a goal. You have to be strong. You have to stay and work with your family. And all of you together can attain that goal. And she was quite interested in my ideas of going into medicine. And she said, if you want to do it and you will succeed. And you have to believe in yourself.
What a fabulous role model. That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
Zella, how about yours?
Yeah. Well, my initial attraction to research came from a book that I read when I was little. And that involved, actually, Marie Curie was my inspiration for research. And that was the first person that I read about doing work, doing science, doing chemistry. And that was my initial drive towards research, curiosity, and Marie Curie. And then I was very, very supported in that decision by my mom, who was a dentist, and her particular desire was to move towards healthcare and not so much research, but the idea of like pushing this curiosity and discovering and reaching to new areas of discovery was what she wanted me to do, and she encouraged me and pushed me.
It's great to know that there are people in your lives that help to encourage you, and thank goodness for that, because we have you here today at Stony Brook, so we're really pleased about that. Asking the next question, what women in your life have had the most influence on you, and in what way? I don't know who would like to answer that question, but...
Well, I mentioned my mom, and she was, in fact, the person who pushed me all the way. My mom's version of that was, you do what you want to do.
Right.
You go seek as much education as you need to seek. So she was the one who encouraged me after I finished my PhD in Greece to move to the States to continue my studies, even though I would be leaving them behind.
Yeah. You never really leave them behind. They're always
with you. So true. So true.
Even when the children leave the nest, they come back.
They do. I'm hoping so.
They do. They come back.
You know, Dr. Nachman, perhaps, what research projects are you currently engaged in?
You know, there's so many unanswered questions in medicine, pediatrics, that we need to sit and think about. And recently, we started an NIH-funded investigation for congenital CMV across the state. We were always bothered by the fact that we don't know what happens to the children who acquire CMV during pregnancy, and they look fine at birth. Do they do okay? Do they not do okay? So about a year and a half ago, the NICHD funded us here at Stony Brook, along with the Wadsworth Labs, to actually look across the entire state, test every baby born for CMV, and then follow all those kids for several years. And what we're seeing, unfortunately, are some surprises that we anticipated and are not happy about. Some babies who are born with CMV have hearing loss, but the vast majority don't. What we're seeing now in our follow-up is some babies who looked absolutely fine at birth and had no hearing loss are starting to get hearing loss by the time they're two or three. And that's quite worrisome. And it teaches us that maybe we need to test hearing earlier, not just when your child gets to school, because that may be a child who will, in fact, be identified as infected, but more importantly, will benefit from hearing testing and treatment. This is an effort that includes the entire New York State. Mm-hmm. So there are no biases. We're not selecting populations. We've taken every single baby, any parent that wanted to sign up, signed up.
That's really exciting. What's the next step in the process with your research?
So that is just one of the projects that we're doing here. As you know, Stony Brook is heavily invested in research across the generations. And while we're doing Suffer CMV, another project that will be coming to fruition soon will be treating pregnant women for their hepatitis C. As you know, on Long Island, and as well as in New York State and many other areas, we have a large population of women that are hepatitis C infected. And right now, those babies have a risk of being born and being infected. The aim of this study, and it is funded, will be to treat those women during their pregnancy and thus avoiding any risk that those babies will be infected, and that will be rolling out in the next few months.
These are really life-saving initiatives, and we are so grateful for the work that you're doing. It's really exciting.
And what's more exciting is they involve the entire family.
Yes.
And that's really, you're not just treating one patient, you're treating the family as a whole, and that's really important as well.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And we always anxiously watch you on the news when you're representing Stony Brook so well and serving as an expert.
And I'm very proud to represent Stony Brook. So thank you for those
opportunities. Well, we enjoy it. We enjoy it. I'm always looking for you. What advice do you wish someone had given you at the start of your career?
That it's not always a straightforward path. You follow all the turns and all the directions. Just follow what fascinates you and you're going to get where you're going. And science is fascinating. It's exciting. And you stay young doing science because you pursue what drives you. And that's the way to go. I mean, it's, as I said, it's not always straightforward. It's not always easy, but it's the way to go. And you gave me a lot of things to think about with your research. Part of what we are doing in our lab is looking at neuroinflammation in different models of disease. And although we're focusing right now on two specific models, one being glioblastoma, brain cancer, sorry, neurological target, the other being neuropsychiatric, we're looking at stress-induced behavioral changes, stress-induced depression. The idea that so we see that neuroinflammation is highly modulatory in these diseases. So unexpectedly, for example, in depression, if you take away neuroinflammation, if you downregulate neuroinflammation, you drastically, at least at preclinical models, you change behavioral outputs of depression so that it's no depression. And you reestablish inflammation and depression symptoms come back, which is fascinating to me. So we are working on that and trying to understand what exactly is happening. But on the glioblastoma, on the other
And we're looking at using inflammation as a tool to attack recurrent tumors. Recurrent glioblastoma has no treatment at this point. It's only experimental, nothing specific and prescribed by as standard of treatment. So modulating neuroinflammation seems, at least again in preclinical models, to have an effect and be quite efficient.
One of the things that's so interesting about Stony Brook is the cross-pollination, in that you can walk in the hallway and see someone else doing something completely different, strike up a conversation, and come away with a aha moment. That's an interesting idea. And I've been fortunate to work with Stella, as well as many of our colleagues on the main campus, Department of Chemistry, et cetera, to actually say, what are you doing? What am I doing? Let's do something together. And I think that's a huge strength of the university.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm seeing that more and more as the years go on and as the departments become connected in a collaborative way to share different ideas in science, in clinical care, and moving from that basic science to translational research to the clinical arena. And what a wonderful way to bring together our tripartite mission at Stony Brook Medicine. So this has been just an absolutely wonderful conversation, and I truly thank both of you for sharing as we celebrate Women's History Month. Please stay tuned, and we'll be right back with two more panelists to discuss women in medicine. Welcome back to HealthCast. I'm now joined by two of our physicians, Tara and Olga. Tara, if you can introduce yourself.
Thank you, Carol.
Sure.
My name is Tara Houston. I am an alumna of the Renaissance School of Medicine, class of 2001, and I'm now a full professor of surgery. I'm president of the Stony Brook Medicine Medical Board and faculty chair of our Committee on Admissions for the Medical School.
Thank you, Tara. And Olga?
Hi, I'm Olga Roniadis, and I'm a professor of medicine here at Stony Brook and the division chief of gastroenterology and hepatology here.
Fantastic. We're so happy to have you here, and I'm going to dig right into it. First, I'd like to ask, what inspired you to pursue a career in medicine?
You know, so when I think about what led me to medicine, it really stems from my parents. I am a product of two immigrant parents who came to this country really with nothing more except for their determination, resilience, and grit, and with a truly unwavering belief in the power of education. And so they really did everything they could to create a better life for our family. And they, all the while, they also contributed to their community in very meaningful ways. And I think that seeing their journey really instilled in me this passion for hard work, for perseverance, and for service to others. And that's what truly led me to medicine. I wanted to be able to honor their sacrifices and dedicate my life to helping others. In addition, medicine not only offers the opportunity to really create very profound and meaningful impacts on people's lives, but it also offers the opportunity to have constant intellectual challenge and stimulation. And that was really appealing to me. And specifically for gastroenterology, it was the combination of the technical skills and the cognitive elements that were a particular draw. You could fix a problem immediately in gastroenterology by a therapeutic procedural intervention, but then you could also create these long-lasting, meaningful relationships with patients over time. And that combination was really what pulled me in. Mm,
that's a fascinating story. Thanks for sharing. Tara, how about you?
So for as long as I can remember, I knew I was going to grow up and be a physician. If you had asked me in kindergarten, what do you want to do when you grow up? I would say, I want to be a physician. I loved school. Like Olga was saying, education was very important to my parents. In high school, I fell in love with science research and decided I want to go to the most difficult college I can, choose the most difficult major I can to best prepare me. In college, I took a number of classes about the health inequities and disparities in research between men and women. And I wanted to go to medical school and become an OBGYN so that I could further the field of women's health. I felt we needed more help. In my third year of medical school, I quickly realized that OBGYN was not a good fit for me, and I fell in love with surgery a couple months later. And then it took me 6 years into my surgical training to realize I didn't want to put people, I didn't want to take people apart anymore. I wanted to put them back together again. And then after 10 long years of surgical training, I found plastic surgery, and that was the right fit for me. And I'm so blessed to be able to do what I do.
You know, I think sometimes we have to go on a journey to get where we eventually belong. And it sounds like you went on that journey and you found where you belong. So we're really glad to have you here in this. So
thank you. What challenges have you faced as a woman in your field? And how did you overcome these challenges?
So, you know, I think the major challenge in medicine really is that women are underrepresented in medicine in general, and certainly in procedural subspecialties like ours. And that really requires navigating that tricky space, really requires that you develop confidence and advocacy, and that you have appropriate mentorship, that you seek out that mentorship. And I think for me personally, that's been really important and impactful, demonstrating your skills, developing an ability to speak up and really seek out mentors, both male and female, that are going to help you navigate and overcome the challenges that we face. I think another key challenge is learning how to balance both personal and professional responsibilities in a really demanding space, in a demanding field. Developing boundaries, setting boundaries, and creating a very strong support system, as well as embracing flexibility, I think have been really key and instrumental in navigating that particular challenge.
Did you have women mentors along the way as you were going through medical school and into your residency?
I did. I was very lucky in that I had both exceptionally strong women mentors and also male mentors as well. And I think the combination just allowed me to see multiple different perspectives. And that was extremely helpful, seeing strong women navigate the field and navigate the space and challenges, as well as seeing how a male or how a men would interact and navigate a particular challenge was very helpful.
And Carol, I think you bring up a good point with male mentors for female medical students and trainees. When I was a medical student here, we had very few women in the Department of Surgery. And I remember way back when I did fall in love with surgery, looking ahead and not seeing very many women. And I think it's very important for young women to be able to see those of us who are a generation ahead of them in the field and happy and successful and possibly having families, if that's something that interests them as well, and enjoying our careers. One of my favorite quotes is, you have to see it to be it. And you don't have to, but it makes it a lot easier. And we actually know in surgery, one of the most important factors for young women choosing a career in surgery is seeing women surgeon attendings being successful and happy.
So I think it's important as we progress in our careers to think about paying it forward to those who are in need of mentors and how much we've learned from our mentors and how it's helped us to grow professionally. So I love the see it to be it. I think that's very wise words of wisdom. So thank you. We're getting into this a little bit, but how have gender perceptions in medicine changed over the course of your career?
I'll get started with that one. Okay. When I started in medical school, we had late 90s, we had 50% of women in the entering class. And we're now up to 55% of women in the entering classes of medical students. So I think from the medical student perspective, we were just all students together. But one big difference from then to now, and Olga alluded to this earlier, but it's women in leadership. And a generation ago, when we didn't have quite as many women in leadership, we figured, well, you know, the generation prior to us, it was mostly men in medical school, so it makes sense. But now I think it's very important that the young women in school and in training see strong women leaders such as yourself at the helm of our institution to know that they can one day be there. You know, in procedural specialties such as surgery for me, gastroenterology for Olga, I think it's a lot more normal now to see a woman in those fields. For years, you would say there are surgeons and there are woman surgeons, or there are female surgeons because it was something completely different, or there are gastroenterologists and there are female gastroenterologists. So I think one change that I believe is happening, that I hope is happening, is it's just normal for both men and women to do the same things, and we don't separate into one field or another based on our gender.
You know, I think another thing that's been really impactful and something I've seen over the years is that conversations, these difficult conversations, are happening in a much more open forum now. There's been active discussion, and there's a lot of engagement and investment from all parties to discuss these issues that are so germane to helping women develop opportunities in the field. And I think that that's been extremely helpful and beneficial. And, you know, much like Tara was saying, although I had had great mentorship from women in medicine and the procedural subspecialties, that was less so. So you had a demonstration of what it was to be possible, what could be. But then again, in those procedural subspecialties, these conversations now are much more open and active. And that's really been fueled and sparked by the fact that there are women in leadership now who are driving, helping to drive the discussions.
No, I love this conversation. And I think also many times communication techniques as well are often brought into gender perceptions. I know that many times people may criticize others for being too kind, for instance. And kindness does not equate to weakness. In fact, people who are kind can be quite decisive, make difficult decisions, hold people accountable, but do it in a respectful way. So I think that, you know, over time, different gender perceptions may morph as we see more women in leadership roles, just with different, perhaps different approaches.
Yeah. You know, Carol, you bring up such a great point, because I think that, you know, what I had wished that someone would have said to me a long time ago, that success in medicine doesn't mean sacrificing your authenticity, that skills like compassion, resilience, collaboration, they're just as important as assertiveness, and really that taking that whole package into account. Those are some of the traits that make women uniquely strong, actually, in leadership positions and in medicine in general.
Really well said. Thank you for that. That was a great summary to that question. So thank you. What excites you about the future of women in medicine?
Take this one, or at least start it off. But I think, you know, the thing that's really exciting is that women are not just participating in medicine. We are leading. We're taking on leadership roles. We are in participating in groundbreaking research and really moving that needle forward, and we're innovating. And so that's a very exciting thing to see, the way that the space has evolved, and women are really shaping what healthcare looks like in the future. And that's been a particularly exciting thing. And I think we're doing it with a sense of collaboration, a supportive community where we're lifting one another up, which I also think is something that's particularly exciting to me.
I am very excited that there are more women in leadership. This is something that we both alluded to earlier, but it's so critical in shaping the future of medicine. As you know, I'm the first woman to be president of the Stony Brook Medicine Medical Board in our 50-year history, and I'm very proud of that. It's an elected position that my fellow physicians allowed me to fulfill, and I'm completing my 3-year term. But I think it's important for our younger faculty to see women in these positions.
So true. It's all about role modeling, right?
Yeah.
What advice do you wish someone had given you at the start of your career?
I'll start with that one.
Okay.
Two major pieces of advice. One, enjoy the journey. It's grueling to go through medical school, to go through residency. A lot of us are getting married during that time. We're starting our families. But as best you can, enjoy the journey. And number two, don't let anyone tell you no. A lot of people are going to try to discourage you along the way, create obstacles, but believe in yourself, remain determined, and you will achieve your goals.
You know, I think hard work isn't enough. You have to really advocate for yourself and really step up and own your space, because no one's going to do it for you. And so that, I think that's very important and something that I wish I had known earlier on. I also think that it's important, particularly to be able to have your own voice and to have for that to be strong. When I think my advice to young women in medicine is this, don't ever shrink to fit into spaces that were not designed for you. You redefine those spaces and own your voice, know your worth, and lift as you climb.
Really well said. And what great advice to end this segment. Thank you both so much for joining me here today.
Thank you.
And to our listeners and viewers, please stay tuned, and we'll be joined by two more women in leadership positions at Stony Brook Medicine. Welcome back. We are now joined by Carolyn Santora and Patricia Cooper, two of my fellow leaders at Stony Brook Medicine. Carolyn, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Carolyn Santora. I'm the Chief Nursing Officer here at Stony Brook University Hospital. And I've been here for 45 years and had all kinds of positions and find myself in this wonderful position right now.
And we're glad that you're here, too, for 45 years.
Patricia. Hi, I'm Patricia Cooper. I'm the Chief Compliance Officer here at Stony Brook Medicine, and I joined just shy of 3 years ago. And what's absolutely beautiful is that I actually received my graduate degree in nursing here at Stony Brook. So it's like being home again.
Very nice. Full circle.
Yeah.
Coming full circle. Well, we're glad you're here too. So we'll just kick it off right away. Just tell me in your own words, what do you believe the definition of an effective leader is?
Well, for me, what an effective leader is someone who is able to inspire and motivate others, but with kindness and humility. I think those are essential.
Thank you.
And in order to be an effective leader, I think you have to have a passion for the mission and a commitment to the people who make that mission happen. So it's that passion coming, leading from the heart.
Yeah, that those are, you know, great definitions for effective leadership. And, you know, I often think about, you mentioned inspiration and motivational, and I often think about followership and the folks that wish to follow people who are inspiring and motivational. So I think that's very important when you're leading in an organization, is to ensure that people have that comfort level to follow.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So thank you. That was great. So what unique qualities do women bring to leadership in healthcare? Can you describe any from your perspective?
I think it's has to do with that inspiration that Pat talked about. It's the concept of authentic leadership particularly fits women nowadays because women have a high level of emotional intelligence. And they do have that passion that they bring, especially to healthcare, especially when you're talking about nurses. And it ultimately leads to being able to have others follow you and do what it takes to be done to meet the mission.
Yeah. I'd also add to that as a woman, you're also resilient, right? Things come your way and you find a way to come up with creative solutions to be able to respond to those items or areas. And I think that's what also makes us unique. And we're also very empathetic.
Empathy. And women tend to build networks of empathy with those that they work with. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that they can increase productivity that way, that people trust them. And there's good data to support women as being emotionally intelligent and giving that authentic leadership quality.
Yeah, we talked a little bit previously in another segment around communication. And I know that there's also great research about even how women situate themselves at a meeting around a table in a more of a circular pattern and, you know, directly face to face. I mean, just different research techniques that I've learned about in response to how women communicate amongst each other. So and with others.
The other piece is the collaboration. We're always willing to bring everyone to the table to hear different viewpoints. And I think that that's really essential because we're cognizant of those times when we've been in a room and we weren't heard. And so we take the time to ensure that every voice is heard. And I think that's really important too.
Great point. I'm glad that you added that. Yeah, that's perfect. So why is it important for women to be in a position of leadership from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, I think it's because we provide a wide array of perspectives. I believe that we as women tend to listen more. We're more willing to, again, collaborate with others, bring additional people to the table. And quite honestly, statistically, I think you mentioned the research, we tend to be more productive. We enhance collaboration. We inspire organization and dedication. And I think these are also very important as women leaders.
And well, and the other reason, of course, is to set an example that people can see women in leadership and aspire to do that also. You know, it's interesting in nursing, of course, women are the majority of this profession. About 12.5% are men, but they represent 25% of leadership in nursing. So you got to question, what is that about? And how did that come about? And I don't want to in any way diminish how important the men are in our profession and what good leaders they really are. But why aren't women reaching those levels? And we really have to support women, set an example, and then be good at what we do.
So really what you're saying as well is as women leaders, we should serve as role models and mentors for others to come.
Exactly.
Right.
I love that you mentioned the mentorship. I think that's essential. Oftentimes people look up towards mentorship, like who can mentor me? But I think that as you get to be leaders, we should also seek to mentor others as well. I think that's absolutely essential. That's how we build community with one another, but also how we build other leaders when people are willing to invest in others.
Yeah, it's so important to pay it forward. I can think of so many women leaders who took the time to provide career advice, to listen to various woes over the years, and just provided such sound advice that really, I feel, made me a better leader. And it's really important to pay it forward and to recognize those who are hoping to aspire to become leaders in the field as women, and we should support them.
I agree.
Yeah. Are there programs or associations for women in leadership that you're aware of?
Well, actually, you don't have to look any further than the School of Nursing. They have a master's program in leadership, in nursing leadership. So you can get a master's degree in that. They also have a certificate program in leadership. So if you're already in a leadership role, if you already have a master's degree, you can get the certificate. And you know, they concentrate on leadership qualities, on leadership structure, and what you need to do actually to move on as a leader. So our own school, HSC, walk across the bridge, you got it.
There you go. Another one is CHIEF. It's a group of women executives, and what they do is they work collaboratively with other leaders so that they can share ideas. It's a thought leadership type of a group. That's really great. But the other thing is we often forget about just our own community and building your own community, right? Because part of those organizations, they start with just a few people working together. And then you surround a shared idea and you can be community for one another as well.
Oh, great suggestions. And I'm sure those who are listening will take heed. So thank you for sharing those thoughts. What steps can healthcare organizations take to ensure gender equity in leadership positions?
So I think for gender equity is to look at everyone, to ensure that every resume that passes through someone's desk, any opportunity that you have in which you can look for other people to be able to fill a role. I think that's really important and really just not being exclusionary. I think that's essential. And again, I can't emphasize enough the importance of mentorship as well, because then you can create your own your pipeline as well.
I don't know, Callan, if you have anything to add to that.
Well, as I said, you know, there is a disproportionate number of men in nursing in leadership positions. There's also a disproportionate number of men in medical leadership, disproportionate to the number of men in leadership. So even though there's now almost 50% of graduates are women, only about 20% of leadership positions in medicine are held by women. So I think we need to be cognizant of that and try to figure out what it is that is holding women back. And does it have to do with their own personal lives, with their aspirations? Are women less likely to put themselves out there for leadership positions? And then support people in those things to help them to be able to do what they need to do in order to move on to leadership.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm very proud to be part of Stony Brook Medicine. I think I said that in a former podcast as well. And I've had the opportunity to grow professionally here, and I'm in the C-suite, and I'm really excited to be part of that, and especially as the first woman CEO at Stony Brook. And so I feel that Stony Brook has really given all of us this opportunity as women leaders in C-suite to be recognized for the work that we do. So I'm proud to be part of Stony Brook Medicine for that reason.
So am I.
As am I.
Yeah. Finally, do you have any advice for women seeking to climb the ladder to a leadership position, particularly administratively?
For me, I really think you need to work on yourself. I think in order for you to walk into any position, you need to work on developing your personal plan. What is your vision for your life? What are some things that you'd like to accomplish? And allow other experiences. I mean, Stony Brook has really great, we have LinkedIn Learning. You can learn a skill. There are a number of things you can do and really develop oneself so that way it prepares you for any opportunity when it comes your way.
And I would also I think you need to be clinically expert. You have to know your business. I said that before. Leading from the heart, understanding what's important in the work that we do, and ensuring that others get support to do that also. So it's always lead from the heart, lead from the heart, lead from the heart.
And boy, when I think about leading from the heart, I think about Carolyn Santora every day.
Oh, you're
so. And we're so grateful to have you. And we're grateful to have you too as well, Patricia.
Every day I feel like I'm blessed.
Yeah, it's a great feeling. But I just really wanted to thank both of you for, an excellent discussion around women leadership. And you're certainly two role models. And anyone watching will know that they can aspire to do the types of things that you've done here at Stony Brook Medicine. And it's just exciting to have both of you here. So thank you. Well, this has just been a really informative series of conversations today. I'd like to thank all of our panelists, and I'd especially like to thank you all for tuning in. Let's celebrate the advancements we've heard about today while remaining committed to building a future in which women's leadership potential is fully realized. The stories of successful women leaders inspire us all. We can use these examples to pave the way for the next generation of female leaders to reach their full potential. Thank you.
Stony Brook Medicine is Long Island's premier academic medical center. We transform lives through scientific discovery, education, and care, and we bring together innovative research, advanced education, and extraordinary healthcare expertise to set the standard for how healthy communities thrive. For more information, visit stonybrookmedicine.edu or follow us on social media, Stony Brook Medicine on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn, and Stony Brook Med on X.